This sermon is titled Making the Impossible Possible. The two scripture lessons are from the Hebrew Bible, Genesis 18, 1 to 15, and from the Christian Testament, Luke 10, 38 to 42. My husband and I had the itch to travel before we settled down and finished school. We worked and were able to save money because of the largesse of our families. We could live with our parents, who provided shelter and food for us. We worked for a year and then biked in the British Isles for 3 months on a shoestring. With campgrounds few and far between, guidebooks suggested we ask farmers if we could camp in their fields. We stayed in a conventional B&B or small motel once a week to enjoy bathing facilities. But most nights we camped. I don't remember many of these places, which were most often run-of-the-mill fields. I remember when one household looked suspiciously at us and asked if we had ID papers and a passport. I didn't imagine many robbers would be escaping on bicycle, but nonetheless we obliged by showing ID. Of course it occurred to them, but not to me, that we might be taking advantage of them in some way. One night we'd already set up our tent and were heating up water on our little camp stove, and we heard a person approaching. The host, the landowner, had come to our tent bearing gifts: fresh milk, cheese, eggs, and bread. I can still see that campsite, the house, and I remember how we melted with appreciation for these gifts. Above and beyond the gift of a place to pitch our tent, the gift of food became a turning point in that trip and maybe in our lives. We were no longer strangers because we had found simple but incomparable hospitality. What is it about hospitality that is so magical? In Genesis and Luke, we have two impromptu dinner parties. Abraham and Sarah give the three strangers water, rest, and food. Jesus is welcomed into the home of Mary and Martha. I have a confession. I have a love-hate relationship with both of these stories. I very often preach the lectionary texts, those that if we follow them cover most of the Bible over 3 years. I do so because otherwise I might not choose some of the scriptures I like least or am ambivalent to, like these. I know I don't have to listen and take the Bible literally, that I can put these stories in the context of a patriarchal culture where women did not have rights. It is still painful to read about women being shamed and corrected in a book I call sacred. I enjoy the story of the three visitors most of the way until the end. It is a story of hospitality, which becomes a lens to see God's power. When one of the visitors announces to Sarah that Sarah will be pregnant this time next year, I like to imagine Sarah hidden in the doorway of the tent, tilted head, eyebrows raised, in the manner of, say, Whoopi Goldberg. I imagine her saying, "What?" At once amused and certain these visitors did not know a thing. My fun imagining is over when I read that Sarah is accused of laughing and then denies that she laughed. Of course it's natural for Sarah to laugh. I can imagine a belly laugh and a broad knowing smile from this postmenopausal woman who knows the impossibility of becoming pregnant at her age. And it's hard to imagine her husband wouldn't also be laughing, the aged man that he was, about himself and Sarah. The only reason I can imagine for Sarah to deny that she laughed is if she felt unsafe, if others might shame her for her reaction. I know this lack of safety existed for women for millennia, and it still exists. And even so, I still feel a pain in my stomach when I read this story, imagining the fear, the lack of freedom of expression for Sarah, and all the women who have experienced this kind of constraint. The next sentence says it all. The visitor judges her and calls her to account. Why? Because she's mystified at the news. It seems to me she was not free to be her authentic self. In the story of Mary and Martha, very often, we interpret this text to say that Jesus is rebuking or shaming Martha for her choice of hospitality, and he praises Mary for her interest in learning from him. Here is the disconnect for me in this passage. This makes no sense because hospitality was everything in the ancient Mediterranean culture. Hospitality was about kindness to strangers, and it was practiced among pagans and Jews and Christians. Hosts were expected to meet the needs for shelter, food, and protection because those strangers might turn out to be angels or gods incognito, as in Genesis. Those ancient peoples gave every traveler the benefit of the doubt and shared generously, because everyone might be in that vulnerable position in the inhospitable climate at some time. This is Jesus' culture, and serving others is the cornerstone of his ministry. This is illustrated in the Gospels in many places, including later in Luke chapter 22, verses 24 to 26, when Jesus defines great discipleship in terms of serving others. In Matthew 25, he says about hospitality, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." So what is going on in this story? Why does Jesus say Mary has chosen the better part or the better path? What are we to make of this comparison that doesn't seem like one Jesus would make? We don't really know if these are Jesus' words. I'm guessing some of you are familiar with the work of scholars of the Jesus Seminar, active in the 1980s and 90s and early 2000s. One of my professors in college, Marcus Borg, was a leader in these seminars, and I followed them pretty closely because I so valued his teaching. I found the process they used fascinating and instructive. The Jesus Seminar was a group of 150 biblical scholars and laypeople who had a deep understanding of the cultures and languages of the first century. They are experts on how wisdom was taught. They study the many fragments of early copies of the Bible and know the various languages the Bible is written in, and also study sacred texts related to our Bible, but not included in it, such as the Gnostic Gospels. Lots of people don't know that Bible scholars of this caliber take 7 to 10 years to get their PhDs because of their extensive language and textual study. So this group met, and from their own studies and learning from each other, they voted on what they believed are the most likely authentic teachings of Jesus and why, and which are more likely teachings added by the author or authors of the books or Christian editors in subsequent centuries. For instance, in this part of Luke, the teaching of the Good Samaritan, which precedes the Mary and Martha story, is considered an authentic teaching of Jesus. But the framing of it, the setup, they believe, was likely Luke's addition. Scholars believe that the story of Mary and Martha was also Luke's addition for a particular reason. The story of the Good Samaritan illustrates how to love one's neighbor, fulfilling the second commandment of the Shema, to love neighbor as self. Mary and Martha is a story that instructs us to love God, which fulfills the first commandment of the Shema, to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind. So there's a balance that Luke may have used to create, to include stories of both of these commandments. One part of me prioritizes Jesus' words that are likely to be more authentic, but the other voice urges me, as one who values how the Christian community formed over time, that I am called to try and understand Luke and other leaders in the early Christian movement as well. We may not give them the same weight as Jesus' words, but we need to wrestle with what they meant because they are part of our tradition. In this story, Jesus is setting up a comparison between Martha making the meal and Mary choosing to learn from him. I do not read Jesus' words as a rebuke. When Martha feels exasperated and complains, Jesus responds saying Martha's name twice. To our ears, this may sound patronizing and disrespectful. But in the first century, according to a scholar I read last week, naming somebody twice is a rhetorical device for showing compassion and care. I give Luke the benefit of the doubt. In this story, Jesus gives preference to Mary's choice of learning and growing, enriching herself by loving Jesus and loving God. So I choose, in my interpretation, to hear the value of loving God and learning rather than understanding this passage as choosing one role over another. Most of all, I want you to wrestle with this too and see where you land in your understanding. Walter Brueggemann is one of my favorite biblical scholars, and he addresses our likes and dislikes in Scripture, sometimes our strong reactions, you know, that we have. He wrote, "We need to be led by the text and to have confidence that this text, despite all its vagaries and violence, its unbearable harshness and confounding cadences, is one that merits our primal attention as the word of life." He calls us to use our intelligence to understand the influence of culture on those who chose what to include in our Bible and what to exclude, to consider human sin, our narrow thinking, our closed hearts. We want to consider all of this when reading and to ask, what is essential in these texts? What is the word of life? For me, what is essential in Genesis 18 is that the expected behavior to be hospitable is really not the point of the story. The hospitality is the precondition for something else, for God's presence. And God's presence in the angels or three visitors, however you read it, opens up the possibility for the seemingly impossible to become possible. Sarah inexplicably will step out of her role as a childless postmenopausal woman. Here is what has seemed impossible for me recently. I truly believe the chance for legislation that supports manufacturing in our country and in which combats climate change was impossible in the next months and years, given the current gridlock in our government, until a couple of weeks ago when it became possible. Is it what I think is fully needed? It is not enough. But I also know I can't conceive of the fullness of our power when we employ love to accomplish God's will, our love of life on this earth, our love of each other. I cannot conceive of the fullness of our power when we employ love to accomplish God's will. What is essential in Luke's story? Martha makes possible Jesus' presence in their home. Mary turns upside down gender roles in the presence of one who's teaching, surprised at every turn. Even in the story of Mary and Martha, even if it is Luke's story, it follows the tradition of Jesus turning traditional norms upside down. I want to celebrate that the impossible becomes possible when we are partners with God. Gender roles are still strong in many cultures, including our own, but people are finding their voice and choice and are freeing themselves from these roles when they choose. When my children were small, I simplified my roles. I said, I love being a mom and I love being a pastor. I celebrate our voice and choice and the new life that is birthed within, however we describe that. I celebrate all who see beyond cultural roles and see paths to liberation. I celebrate, for instance, that the Prime Minister of Barbados, her name is Mia Mottley, is fighting for economic justice for all small nations disproportionately affected by climate change. There are so many people to celebrate. So when Jim and I were biking long ago, when we experienced just a little of this warmth from strangers, it affected us for a lifetime. It is a quality of welcome that stayed with us and has inspired us to invite immigrants and others, other travelers into our home. Some of you know I love empowering communication or nonviolent communication because for me it goes hand in glove with Christianity. The other day I had a chance to be hospitable to people unknown to me at the Park District pool where I swim. This park district attracts people who are of many faith traditions and many nationalities. I am guessing many are recent immigrants because I hear many languages spoken. Everyone is there to enjoy exercise and dancing aerobics and machines and walking and running and swimming. A few weeks ago, I had observed a pool manager, who is a white woman, speak what seemed to me authoritatively, certainly within her role, but not with care and understanding that I would expect to people of color on one or two occasions when they needed to move lanes to make room for scheduled swimming lessons. I didn't have enough data points to know if her tone of voice was the same when she spoke to white people. On those occasions, I just observed and I didn't say anything. The other day, there was a Muslim family swimming in two lanes and a Hispanic family swimming in a third lane. They were in the lap pool, but not doing laps. The woman manager, again, used a tone of voice that I sensed did not have full respect in it when she told these families they needed to get out and move to the splash pad area because swimming lessons would begin shortly. The children had long faces. My body was telling me again that the manager's voice lacked respect. After my swim, I noticed that one swim lesson had begun in the first lane, but there were still three lanes now open, not being used. I asked the Hispanic mom in the hot tub if she knew why the children were not being permitted to swim in the lap pool. She understood what I did, that some swim lessons didn't materialize, and so she didn't know why they couldn't swim. I asked, would the children like to swim more? She said yes. I went to the manager, longing to understand and not wanting to shame her for her words to the families. I said, I'm aware that on many days I often see children playing in the lap lanes when they are not filled with lap swimmers. She chimed in this was true in a respectful tone of voice. I continued saying I'm touched that the children who just got out were disappointed and wanted the fun of swimming in the pool. I see there are three lanes still open. Then I made a request for understanding. Is there a reason they couldn't use these lanes? The manager said all the swim lessons hadn't shown up and that the children could use the open lanes. So I let the children's mother know. I believe the manager's voice may have come from racism, and I trust that inquiring about the availability of the lanes opened up a new possibility that we can all work together for the common good. I know the Ministry of Hospitality is the work of many people here at Church of the Three Crosses. When we are doing it, we are setting up conditions for God to be present. There may be no other ministry as important for Church of the Three Crosses in all churches than expecting God to visit in the form of a stranger and imagining old and new ways to welcome them.